Hello and welcome to the weekly look around Africa and the Middle East for the aerospace, defence and aviation industries. I'm Alan Peaford. Well, I've been practicing what I preach this week and have taken my first commercial flight in 7 months. I must say the onboard experience with Emirates was excellent, and at no stage on the entire flight did one feel at risk. Dubai Airport Terminal 3 was sadly very quiet, ghost-like almost as you walked your way through it, and I was very disappointed that the contactless e-gates were not in operation. But all movement through the airport was safely managed, and I really do think that if the various quarantine rules are eased, there will be a lot more people ready to get back in the air. But anyway, instead of worrying about COVID, we can now go back to worrying about normal things, like wildlife around an airport. Our airport's editor, Chloe Greenbank, has been looking at how airports in Africa manage the risk of wildlife, particularly on the runways. And our MRO editor, Chuck Grieve, is taking a look at modifications and what is needed for consistent standards. But first, let's hear the news headlines from Marcella Nethersole at the Times Aerospace News Desk.
Hello, and here is this week's aviation news from across the Middle East and Africa. IATA this week presented new analysis showing that the airline industry cannot slash costs sufficiently to neutralise severe cash burn, to avoid bankruptcies and preserve jobs in 2021. IATA reiterated its call for government relief measures to sustain airlines financially and avoid massive employment terminations. It also called for pre-flight COVID-19 testing to open borders and enable travel without quarantine. Air Link, the privately owned airline, has officially changed its name from SA Airlink to Air Link. Earlier this year, Air Link ended its 23-year franchise agreement with South African Airways and began operating and issuing tickets on its own. This has liberated Air Link, the airline says, and has enabled it to forge commercial ties with other international carriers. It has already signed interline agreements with airlines including Qatar Airways and Emirates. Etihad Airways has launched the world's first transition Sukuk, the first sustainability-linked financing in global aviation, under a transition finance framework. The $600 million transaction will support Etihad's drive for sustainable aviation by linking the Sukuk terms to Etihad's carbon reduction targets. A commitment to net zero carbon emissions by 2050, a 50% reduction in net emissions by 2035, and a 20% reduction in emissions intensity in the airline's passenger fleet by 2025. Ethiopian Airlines has received two Dash 400 aircraft from de Havilland Aircraft of Canada. This included the airline's 30th Dash 8400 aircraft. Tewolde Gebremariam, Ethiopian's Group Chief Executive Officer, said the Dash 8400 aircraft continues to provide the operational flexibility, exceptional performance the airline needs, as well as supporting the cost leadership strategy it relies on in its market, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. IATA and the World Meteorological Organization have signed an agreement to increase and improve the automated reporting of weather data by commercial aircraft. The new initiative, called the WMO and IATA Collaborative AMDAR program, aims to expand the system to ensure coverage over data-sparse areas. The AMDAR observing system produces over 800,000 high-quality observations per day of air temperature and wind speed and direction, with an increasing number of humidity and turbulence measurements being made. Alpha Aviation Simulator Center has officially opened near its academy at Sharjah International Airport. The centre is equipped with an Airbus A320 fixed base that has both classic CFM-CEO and CFM-NEO LEAP engine options. The company's general manager, Nadem El-Hamad, said the centre's aim is to bridge simulated training gap during such unprecedented times. Egypt Air Training Academy will also be launching a new simulator for the Airbus A320-NEO, as its parent carrier becomes the first operator of the type in Africa in mid-November. The simulator is being prepared for its journey to Egypt Air Training Academy at Cairo International Airport by manufacturer L3 Harris. Cavotec has won a contract to supply its in-ground fueling systems to Sabiha Gökçen International Airport. The system consists of more than 180 fuel pit boxes and a number of advanced valve chamber access covers as part of the airport's modernisation programme. Deliveries are scheduled to start at the end of this year. And finally, you could soon get above those traffic holdups in Dubai, Lagos or Cairo, as Slovakia's Klein Vision has announced a true world first. Its aircar V5 has completed airport flight tests, accelerating its goal of bringing a commercially available aircar model to market within the next 6 months. The company said the aircar could be used for leisure and self-driving journeys, and also as a commercial taxi service, with a dual-mode transformation vehicle going from driving to flying mode with the click of a button. The two-seat model can take you from ground to sky with a takeoff of 300 metres, reaching speeds up to 200 kilometres per hour, with stability and controllability accessible to any pilot. Well, that sounds like a new boy toy for you, Alan. What do you think? Here's back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Ella. Aviation safety is always at the forefront of our industry, and I was stunned to be told by our airports editor, Chloe Greenbank, that as much as 3% of aircraft accidents are caused by wildlife, with bird strikes in particular. Here is her report.
Wildlife hazard management is integral to ensuring safe airport and aircraft operations. Bird strike is a particular risk to the industry, with the Federal Aviation Administration estimating that it costs airlines around $1.2 billion annually. It also represents more than 3% of all aviation accidents. Today, I'm joined by Kerrion Henshaw, Director of Operations at Aviair, a wildlife hazard management company working with airports around the world, to find out more about the impact of wildlife populations in and around airports. Kerrion, for those that don't know, can you tell us a little bit more about Aviair and why wildlife hazard management is so integral to ensuring safe airport operations?
Okay, so Aviair is a consultancy with people with long-standing experience in operational and strategic wildlife hazard management. We specialise in strategic wildlife hazard management. We are all about finding the most appropriate solutions in the most time and cost-effective way for an airport. It's a very difficult time for airports under normal circumstances, with limited budgets, with the impact of COVID-19. The budgets are even worse. So it is really critical that they get the support they need to ensure that we maximise the air safety perspective in, as I should say, most time and cost effective manner possible.
And you've touched on the point there that both ACI and IATA have already suggested that the air traffic is down more than 60% this year to date due to COVID-19. You've touched on that. But what does this lack of activity mean for the presence of wildlife in and around airports? And what are the implications for a wildlife hazard management plan?
It's an interesting question, one that's being debated quite a lot within the industry at the moment. There's suggestion that activity levels for some have gone up, some are not seeing that much change. Fundamentally, it has presented an opportunity for a lot of the airports that we've spoken to get ahead on their environmental management. It's the environment that has the most significant factor of influence on the occurrence of birds, wildlife, within a conflict zone with an aircraft. And if they can keep on top of the environment, then they can actually reduce the likelihood of the strike risk.
You're currently working on a project in the Gambia at Banjul Airport. The Gambia is renowned as a bird lover's paradise. I believe there are around 580 bird species to be seen. So how great is the risk of bird strike at Banjul, and what are you doing to mitigate this risk?
Okay, there is a strike risk at Banjul, but there's a strike risk around all airports. Banjul is complicated by the fact that it has a double migratory bird system there. So it is challenged, but it's actually what is occurring on the airfield and around the airfield, which is succeeding in reducing the likelihood of a strike risk. We spent the last 9 months actually supporting them to develop a better understanding of the factors of influence. We talk with the operational staff, but we also work very, very closely with airport management and with key authorities out the airport as well. They all have a part to play in mitigating it. They work together in reducing the factors which attract the birds into a position where they might be a risk for the aircraft. One of the key things in Banjul is waste management, and it's waste management outside the airport by reducing the attractant for the vultures, for the kites, to the what can be enormous waste dumps. We are actually mitigating the likelihood of birds occurring within the flight paths for aircraft approaching or taking off from the airport.
And obviously you say you're working closely with the Gambia Civil Aviation Authority to manage wildlife populations within the airport perimeters. But how are the local landholders around the airport then in terms of working with you? Are they approachable? Are they open to working with you in that, or is it a problem?
No, not at all. Networking and working in partnership with the key authorities and local communities is really, really important, and it's been a really significant success factor. We do a lot of outreach work. We work with the elders in the community. We work with the schools. I work very, very closely with the Office of the President in Gambia. I still speak to them despite the COVID impact. I'm still speaking to them regularly by Zoom and other means. We work together to understand what everybody can do. The key thing in the Gambia is that it's a Gambian problem, which Gambia has actually said it's theirs. They recognize it as a national problem. It's not just the GCA's problem or the airport's problem. It is a Gambian problem, and it's going to be the Gambia that resolves it. That was virtually the first meeting I went into. Fantastic response. They are very much about working together, addressing the waste management issues, which were referred to, the abattoir issues, looking at what they can do to just dial back all the factors which are influencing. And it's really, really worked. The complete network, not just the guys on the airfield, but everybody has really, really borne some successes. And it continues. Today.
And obviously there's no one size fits all solution, you know, all airports are different, but is there a common species of bird that is, you know, the most common cause of bird strike, and what are the most popular methods or measures when it comes to reducing bird strike in the airports?
It would be nice if all airports are the same, but they're not. They're all different. The environment on and around an airport is always very, very different. And the species can vary as well. It's the occurrence rate. So it's what are the species types and what are their occurrence levels? And those are the factors which are important to be aware of. And also what is attracting those birds? You know, where are they roosting? Where are they moving to nest? Where are they loafing? Each airport is unique. So unfortunately, each airport has to develop its own wildlife hazard management plan, particular to their circumstances. The techniques which are used, well, there's two ways. There's the proactive and then there's the reactive. The most key thing, especially in Africa, boots on the ground, as we call it, is people actually doing something. There is no silver bullet. I'm sorry to disappoint the industry, but there is no silver bullet out there. You can't just go and put in a single item and it'll achieve it. You still definitely need the human being there to understand and interpret what's going on properly and reliably. Birds, largely, and wildlife, largely predictable, but there is an element of unpredictability which you still need to deal with. Technique wise, there's nothing wrong with actually someone with traditional shouting very loudly and waving. If you've got nothing else that's effective, then you can actually use a selection of other, what are not expensive solutions, a very pistol, bioacoustics, you can use gas cannons, but you have to use them carefully. Each species reacts in a very different way. Some are attracted to the equipment which is being used. Some are actually deterred.
And obviously we've spoken about bird strike, but it's not just birds that are a risk, especially I imagine at African airports in more remote locations. You know, I imagine elephants, wildebeest, baboon, they're all going to run across the runway and cause those obstructions. So is it a particularly different tactic you need to employ to deter that sort of wildlife compared to birds? Or
you're right, we deal with mammals, we deal with reptiles, some very, very big snakes on occasions, and you can also deal with insect issues as well. They can also be a threat for aircraft. So fundamentally, the difference is not really there. You need to understand each of the individual species which are presenting a threat, what their characteristics are, what are the factors of influence? So what are the environmental factors? What are the climatic factors? What are the human factors? And then look at which ones we can actually influence, dial back, so that the attractant for that creature to be in that conflict zone, you know, where the aircraft is on the airfield or actually in approach or climb out, is dialed back. We don't have a problem with some of them actually being within the grassed areas. It's when they actually come into the actual runway. That's when the conflict is. They can be useful out there. We don't mind snakes as long as they're not actually on the runway.
And prior to the pandemic, passenger numbers in Africa were forecast to double over the next 20 years. Over the long term, that growth is still expected to happen. But, bird strikes are also reportedly on the rise. Migratory patterns are changing with climate change. So what is your advice to African airports in particular? And are there any regulatory requirements you'd like to see being introduced with regards to this?
The regulatory requirements which come down from ICAO are good. They're very much about standard and recommended practice, the SARPs. They exist. I would encourage that people look to follow them, not just as a tick box exercise, but actually the quality of what's being undertaken. It's really important that people do things properly. The other thing is understanding each individual's circumstances. The radar is absolutely ideal, but it's not the be-all and end-all, but it's actually understanding your species and those factors. Invest the time in understanding, get good quality data and understand good quality risk assessments. Then you can have the most pragmatic, cost-effective plan that you need. You can focus where your efforts where they most need to be. You can use the equipment and techniques which are most effective. It allows you to be very strategic. I would really, really encourage the airports looking at being able to evidence what they're doing as well. For a lot of the airports that we talk to, they are doing good things, but there's no evidence. So it's providing that assurance process back to the airlines. The airlines want to know what's going on. Okay, let's make sure that they see what's happening. Let's be able to demonstrate what's happened in the past. And it's building up that trust between all the different stakeholders, what's actually happening and dealing with the reality of it. Let's not second guess. Let's establish the facts. Let's understand the facts. And then let's deliver the most appropriate solutions where they're needed, on or off an airfield.
Great. Thank you, Kerrion. Good luck with your trip to the Banjul, and thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Chloe. Well, let's look now at an increasingly important part of the MRO sector. The Independent Aircraft Modifier Alliance, IAMA, was launched last year to promote uniform standards and visibility in the worldwide retrofit market. It's focused on modifications carried out under Supplemental Type Certificates, or STCs, which will be of particular interest now as airlines face significant pressure on their balance sheets. Our MRO editor, Chuck Grieve, has been hearing about the organisation's latest steps towards a recognised, audited set of standards.
IAMA created its rulebook to establish standards and best practices for the complete life cycle of aircraft modifications. It's aimed at both the MROs carrying out the work and the owners and operators of the aircraft. I'm speaking today to Romain Maboyang-Seppo, who is Technical Director for Eclipse Technics, a founder member of IAMA, along with Envoy Aerospace, Etihad Engineering, and Lufthansa Technik. Romain, the aircraft modification industry is well established. Why does it need a rulebook?
In fact, we, from the start of IAMA, we identified and we share between all our organizations, our entities, that we all faces the all are facing the same problems, meaning or the same issue with our customers. They're all having the same demands and some expectation, and we have a difficulty, let's say, to answer those demands. So we all share those demands, and we said, okay, we need to collectively provide some rules that we will all apply to make sure that we, as IAMA members, will provide a quality services to our customers and operators and lessors because they need them, and we definitely need to have this to support the quality of our delivery. So that's why we started from this thoughts and said we will develop then a rule book from which we will have all these standards applied to our project that will be delivered in good quality to the expectation of our customers.
Right. Since March, when the rule book was first published, modifiers and operators will have had a chance to look at it, to work with it. How has the response been so far?
So today it has been freshly disseminated in our platforms. From now, we have a very positive feedback on the rulebook, and we expect all the MROs, the operators, to provide to us their feedbacks to say if it fits their demands and the expectation, and even to provide us some way of improving our rulebook.
You're the chairman of the IAMA Standard Working Group that's responsible for the rulebook. What are some of the challenges you've faced in its preparation?
Practically, what was the challenges for us was first to say we want to have a rulebook, but that will not reinvent the wheels, meaning that we will have some prescription to say we must follow that, but we would avoid to make something that will look like the something that already exists. I was thinking of the AS9100, in fact. So let's start to have something that is very specific and that will really address the demands that we have from the field. We are remaining competitors, so we must have something that allow us to have our own DNA in the project anyway. So to limit, in fact, the prescription of our standard. So it was something that was tricky to address and to work with, but we have done it because, in fact, we have organize the rulebook to make sure that the rule will be followed properly. But besides, we have also released what we call best practice. This is a practice that we propose to follow to answer to the rules. So, but it is just a proposal, and each entity is has the freedom to use any other way of being compliant to the rule. In fact, we also have some, as we have US company, we have European company, and we have some system approval between the FAA and EASA are somewhat different. So from time to time, we had issues of saying what can be a rule that can be applied to both systems. For instance, we were speaking of minor modification, and minor modification where in EU they can be directly approved by the entity under our DOA. It is not the case in US where minor approval that are released by entities which are not TC holder, they need to have an STC for that. That was a question that was reason. It was some kind of subject that we had to address. And when you read the rulebook, in fact, you will see that we are speaking of STC and we are not speaking of approval.
Yes, sounds like there were some problems there, but you managed to overcome them. Recently, you brought out an update to the rulebook covering right to use and demodification. Is this a particularly thorny issue for operators?
We all share that the right to use was asked by our customer very late in the process. So we have different view of what is the right to use. So we think together of what is a real right to use letter that we need to provide that will fill the expectation and the request of our customer and their needs. So we provide best practices for that, and we provide an answer to that that can be used by anybody using the standard. And it is also providing anticipation within the project, because we will then in advance in the project ask any customer of this right to use letter to make sure that we will provide with the end of the project this letter. So yes, it is something that is very thorny for that subject. And for the demodification itself, yes, because when aircraft change of operators, and when aircraft is used or is owned by lessors, we need to demodify the aircraft. And demodification is something very tricky. It will drive the initial design of our solution that we provide. And also, when it comes very late, because it can be asked 5, 10, 15 years after the modification has been implemented, then it can be very difficult to provide a full answer and a full demodification. So that's why we said, if a demodification is anticipated, it needs to be addressed directly during the initial process.
You do describe the rulebook as a living document. What other areas of the STC process can we expect to see it dealing with in the months or years ahead?
One other subject that we are currently thinking of is the maintainability subject. do we need, or how can we address the maintainability or standardize the maintainability aspect in our project, making sure that we provide solution projects that are really not intrusive in the maintenance of the aircraft. Maintenance is cost, and we must support our customers to save any cost with the maintenance of our STC.
Well, that's it from us this week. I'm going to be heading back off to Dubai Airport to try another one of those flights to see how it goes. And I hope to be back with you next week. And until then, keep safe. Goodbye.